Instruments ready?
Yes, Doctor.
Skin prepped?
Yes, Doctor.
Okay. Scalpel.
Hemostats, please.
How's the blood pressure?
Okay. Cautery? Dilator?
Is the ventricle open?
Yeah, yes, I can see the defect.
WCCO and Twin City Federal present Minnesota Milestone. Medicine Man to Miracle Drug. The Story of Medicine. In Pioneer, Minnesota, you had to be strong to survive. The climate was not always kind, food not always plentiful, water not always pure, and good shelter hard to come by. Disease was a constant problem. So if you lived in Pioneer, Minnesota, you dosed yourself with nostrums and consulted the quacks, and the death rate was high. But the light of science shone through. Men built fine medical schools and hospitals, providing good doctors and research. A little clinic in a small Minnesota town grew and became world famous. And through knowledge came courage and hope. Hope for the sick and the suffering, for the infirm, the crippled, and the mentally ill. This is the story of a better life through medical science in Minnesota. I'm E.W. Zeebar.
I am Cedric Adams.
I am Bob DeHaven.
And this is the 12th in a series of special hour-long broadcasts commemorating Minnesota's 1958 statehood centennial. This year-long series, Minnesota Milestones, is presented by WCCO Radio and Twin City Federal. For the next hour, we will recall how it all happened. The medicine man, the days of home remedies and patent medicines, the rise of a competent medical profession, stripping the fakes and the quacks of respectability. The thrilling story of the Mayo Clinic, the University of Minnesota, and the wonders of modern medical science. This is another chapter in the story of you and your state, Minnesota, medicine man to miracle drug. The sound which you are now hearing is the DeWall heart-lung machine, a modern medical miracle which can temporarily assume the function of the heart and lungs of a patient during delicate heart surgery. We are in an operating room at the University of Minnesota Hospitals. In this room, in addition to the skilled team of surgeons, nurses, and attendants, is an elderly man.
Tall walls, bright lights, everything so sterile. Who am I to be here? 50 years of a country doctor's practice hasn't prepared me for this miracle. An operation inside a human heart. Unbelievable. How can it succeed? I'm a doctor, yet I know nothing. Nothing. I brought babies into the world. Hundreds, maybe thousands. Scores of appendectomies, mangled hands crushed by primitive farm machinery, bodies broken in traffic accidents. I've doctored folks winter and summer, seen epidemics, smallpox, diphtheria, influenza, and polio. Years and years of practice, and I'm still not ready. They're really doctors. I've known lots of quacks who called themselves doctors. I can't remember the old Indian medicine man, but I do remember the old medicine show.
Yes, sirree, this is the Kickapoo Medicine Show. And these, my friends, these happy dancing warriors, these are the famous Kickapoo Indians. On my right is Chief Foxtail, and on my left is Big Chief Bearclaw. All right, boys, you can take a little rest now. Now, this you won't believe, ladies and gentlemen, but these two chiefs, these two fine specimens of manhood, are both more more than 90 years old. And why are they 90 years old? My friends, let me tell you one of the fascinating secrets of the ages. The secret of Kickapoo Indian swamp root. A secret that has been handed down from medicine man to medicine man, from chief to chief, all through the ages. Yes, my friends, you will thank your lucky stars for this day, all the rest of your long, long life. Now listen carefully, good citizens, for I'm going to give you a partial list, just a partial list, mind you, of the scourges of mankind that Kickapoo juice has cured. Lumbago, rheumatism, aching joints, faulty vision, heart trouble, including shortness of breath, stiff muscles, sleeplessness, cancer, and the three G's, gout, goiter, and grip. 3 spoons of this golden elixir, and Grandma will go dancing again. You will be thankful for the day you heard of Kickapoo elixir and swamp root. You will be thankful you stepped up and paid just $1 for this amazing aid to longevity, this fantastic elixir of life. One bottle? All right, sir, thank you. You'll never forget this. And 2 bottles for you, sir. 2 bottles of Kickapoo elixir and swamp root. Now there, folks, is a man of foresight. Now, don't push me, sir. Don't push me now. Thank you.
Yes, the old medicine show, it was a weird and flamboyant institution built upon the medical ignorance and superstition of the early settlers, plus their love of a good show. That was a part of medicine in pioneer days, and the medicine show lasted for years, on through the 1800s. After the turn of the century, it was still there, the wagon drawn up in small towns, at county fairs, and the pitchman selling worthless nostrums. But the pitchman didn't convince everybody. There were those who depended on Grandma's good old tried and true remedies.
I be a-feeling mighty poorly this morning.
Now, Ernest, did you do like I tell you last night?
Yeah, I biled up some blood root and drunk it.
And did you rub the skunk oil on your chest?
Oh, now, Granny.
Now, don't you granny me. You want to get rid of this cold, don't you? Then you rub on this skunk oil.
Oh, Granny, that means I gotta sleep out in the barn tonight.
There were herbs used as laxatives there in the pioneer days. Rhubarb root, senna leaves, castor oil. Camphor or a liniment made of vinegar and salt were used for bruises. Pennyroyal was gathered on the prairies and was used to break a fever. And of course, in the spring, the blood was thick after the winter. It had to be thin, the old-timer said. And that meant sulfur and molasses and dandelion root tea. People took thoroughwort and tansy, wormwood and pumpkin seeds. And whiskey taken internally quite liberally, for medicinal purposes, of course. As the years went by, men of enterprise, with an eye on the dollar, reasoned that what Granny could do, they could do even better. That is, boil up herbs, mix in a liberal dose of alcohol, bottle and sell the stuff. There was Ayer's Wild Cherry Pectoral, Hood's Sarsaparilla, Dr. Kilmer's Swamp Root, and Dent's Toothache Gum. Many of these familiar household remedies lasted well into the 1900s, before modern medicine and pure food and drug laws finally brought them under control. The toothache. Here was a universal problem. Every person suffered immensely at some time in his life with decaying teeth. Dentists were scarce. Sometimes the nearest one would be 100 miles away. The pain of decaying teeth, a swollen jaw, were something to be borne, to be endured, until at last the offending teeth rotted away. In towns where there were doctors, teeth were extracted with crude forceps. And in some families, well, there was only one thing to do, and Pa usually did it.
I'm getting my pliers. I've had all of this moaning and groaning I can stand. Ain't nobody had a night's sleep in this house for a week.
No, Pa! No, Pa! Please, Pa, don't pull it! Don't pull it! It'll hurt!
Oh, Pa, do you have to pull it? It's so cruel. Seems unhuman, like our Johnny was a horse or something.
Nah, Ma, you look here. This boy'll suffer and suffer for months if I don't. You just quit talking and hold him down. All right now, son, open up.
Oh,
keep quiet. Quieter. All right, now, here, let me get a good hold on it. There, I got it. Hard on his shoulders now, Ma. There, I got it. Look at that.
Yes, that's the way it was. before modern dentistry. And in those days, a man or a woman who lived to be 50, 55, or 60 years old had lived out his or her time. But the ague, fever, tuberculosis, diphtheria, smallpox, appendicitis, influenza, all took their toll. And thousands of settlers departed this life long before their time. And the children cried piteously and then died in epidemics that swept the land. Such an epidemic was the silent death, diphtheria, back in the 1880s. It swept through the whole town of Sleepy Eye, took all or nearly all the children in many families. Fred Gerboth and his wife had a family of six, a boy and five pretty girls. Within days, they had laid away all five girls, and only the boy was left to them. 5 miles southeast of town lived Louis Hansen. He and his wife had five children, and the dread scourge took all five. The neighbors wept as they saw Louis Hansen drive by in his wagon, hunched over in the seat holding the reins. In the wagon, another pine box, another trip to the cemetery. And that was the story, not only in pioneer days, but well within the memory of Minnesotans now living. Untold hardship and grief. And the people, even less wise than the quack doctors, accepted the medical cults, the homeopaths and the eclectics, the hydropaths and the Grahamists. Yet there were good doctors, a few, educated in the East in competent medical schools. Such was Minnesota's first recorded family doctor, a young Italian named Christopher Carley. He paddled up the St. Croix in 1841 and hung up his shingle in the village of Stillwater. There were good doctors at Fort Snelling, brought there by the army to care for the soldiers. In the village of St. Anthony, there was Dr. John Murphy, the town's first civilian doctor. One day, Colonel John Stevens needed the services of Dr. Murphy.
The morning of April 30th, 1851, was the coldest April day on record. Snow blew in from the north in an arctic blast. The riverbank was full and the waves were high. It was almost impossible to cross the Mississippi either in a bateau, skiff, or canoe. Yet it was necessary that I should have communication with St. Anthony because the services of Dr. Murphy were required in my family. With much difficulty and some danger, the crossing was made and we safely returned with Dr. Murphy. About noon on that bleak, cold, eventful day, my first child and the first-born white child on the west bank of St. Anthony Falls was added to my happy household.
That experience told by Colonel John Stevens was not much different than stories told by other settlers and by other country doctors in Minnesota's long history.
By other country doctors in Minnesota's long history. And I suppose by other doctors yet to come. Or will it be that way? It can't be. With all the miracles of medical science, how a man's mind wanders at a time like this. Let's think about the operation. Wonder how the patient is doing. Not just a patient, a kid. Poor little boy. It's a long chance. Had to take it, though. Only hope. It was the only hope we had. The way that doctor handles a scalpel. Sure, quick. No hesitation. Better listen.
Can you feel it?
Uh-huh. In the interventricular septum.
Right where we figured.
The exact spot.
Yeah, let's have the suction here. Yeah, that's right. Okay, that'll do it.
So far, so good. Yeah, maybe I could sort of ease around the other side.
Blood pressure?
115 over 70.
Turn for a moment from medical progress to personal progress. Let's look at a tried and true way that you and your family can use to reach some of those dreams you're dreaming. It's really very simple. It's saving money the Twin City Federal way. Because Twin City Federal is a savings and loan association, the dollars you save go right to work. They build homes. Besides being a safe investment, this earns a liberal return for your money. For example, the current rate is 3.5% compounded quarterly, added to accounts 4 times a year. Twin City Federal takes the added precaution of insuring your account up to $10,000 with a permanent agency of the United States government. So the next time you're downtown in St. Paul or Minneapolis, how about stopping in where the twin clock flashes the time and the temperature? Start saving regularly at Twin City Federal. It's a safe place to save, it's a convenient place to save, and you always earn a generous return. Twin City Federal, the $300 million savings institution, where the twin clock flashes the time and the temperature in downtown Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Those two surgeons are. One on the right side looks 50-ish to me. Other fellow, though, quite young. 40, 42 maybe. Doesn't seem like it was 56 years since I started out as a country doctor. Can't believe it. I just can't believe it.
The country doctor. Back in the 1800s and until the automobile came on the scene, his hallmark was the prancing steed and the light, fast buggy, and the telephone that always seemed to jangle off the wall in the middle of the night. Back before that, when there were no telephones, it was that infernal pounding on the door.
All right, I'm coming!
Doc, you gotta come right away. Been an accident down to Henry Johnson's place, and Henry fell right out of the haymow. He's all busted up, leg all twisted funny. Looked like it's broken in a couple of places. He's an awful pain.
Okay, come in, George. No, wait. You go out and hitch up Maud. I'll throw on my clothes and get my kit. Be out in 5 minutes.
All right, Doc.
And then the wild night ride on the swaying buggy, on frozen wintry roads, on muddy, rainy ones, through snowstorms and floods with the water halfway up the wheels. The scared white faces of the family, the victim whiter still, face chalky, breathing heavily. They laid him out on the kitchen table and set the leg by the flickering light of the kerosene lamp. That was country doctrine the way it used to be. And such a man was Dr. William W. Mayo, a country doctor at first. He was born in England, came to Minnesota in 1854. After spending some time in St. Paul, he moved to Le Sueur. During the Sioux Uprising, he was surgeon for the defenders of New Ulm. And later he moved to Rochester, Minnesota. Dr. Mayo was kindly and sympathetic, yet dignified and reserved. No one, not even his wife, ever called him Bill. And only a few close friends called him William. He had a strict code of professional conduct, which extended to his dress. Always a long-tailed, double-breasted coat and a tall top hat. No Mayo Clinic then, just the country doctor. It was in the 1880s that Dr. Mayo's two sons, William James and Charles Horace, received their medical degrees and joined their father at Rochester. No one knows when an idea begins, and the Mayo Clinic started as an idea, a great one. Perhaps it began when Dr. Will and Dr. Charlie joined their father in his office there in Rochester. Maybe it began that 21st day of August, a hot, sticky day in August back in 1883. The two brothers were on their way home after a day's work at the office when they saw it, the huge, whirling, funnel-shaped cloud moving toward them. It swept right into Rochester. Dr. Will and Charlie saw buildings sucked into the vortex like wheat into a thresher, saw the pieces blown out in all directions like chaff. They saw a grain elevator topple, railroad cars careened down the tracks. The air was full of planks, shingles, bricks, and tree limbs. They ducked into a blacksmith shop, and just then its tin roof whirled away, ripped off by the tornado's fury. They huddled there until the wind subsided. They turned back to help, though, when they were told there were dead and injured in North Rochester. Temporary hospital quarters were set up in Rommel's Dance Hall, since there was no hospital in Rochester then. By 11 o'clock, there were 34 injured patients, and they went to work. Old Dr. Mayo suggested that the Sisters of St. Francis act as nurses. A few days later, the crisis over, the temporary hospital closed, the Mother Superior, Mother Alfred, called on Dr. Mayo.
Ah, Reverend Mother, it's good to see you.
Thank you, Dr. Mayo. Doctor, don't you think it would be well to build a hospital in Rochester?
That's a fine idea, Reverend Mother, but I do not think Rochester is ready for a hospital at this time. Our city is too small. It would cost a great deal of money. I don't believe it would succeed, not at this time.
I'm sorry, Doctor, but I've already made up my mind. I have decided that if you will take charge of a hospital, we, the Sisters of St. Francis, will finance it.
Mother Alfred was not to be deterred. She made Dr. Mayo promise to draw up the plans and leave the financing to her. Dr. Mayo was not being stubborn. The general impression in those days was that a hospital was a place to go and die, not a place to get well. And doctors, reliable doctors, in reporting their mortality rates, sometimes ask allowances for the disadvantages of a hospital atmosphere. So it was no wonder that old Dr. Mayo was not enthusiastic about Mother Alfred's plan. But at last, through hard work, through frugal living, the Sisters of St. Francis did raise the money. This was the era in which the fame of the Mayos was spreading all around Minnesota. A favorite story told by residents of a small community near Rochester concerned an Irishman regarded as one of the seven wonders of the world.
And there goes Pat Glynn, a fine figure of a man. And who would be thinking to look at him that Will Mayo cut a piece out of his stomach?
At first, the older doctors shook their heads.
The way those Mayo boys cut up their patients, why, it's scandalous. It's malpractice, that's what it is.
Now, Henry, I know how you feel, but right here in our own town, take Mrs. Schultz. Why, she wouldn't be alive today if Dr. Will hadn't had the courage to remove that tumor.
Well, I know, Sarah, but... Oh, I guess you're right. I have to admit I don't have the nerve those boys have.
Dr. Will and Dr. Charlie were pioneers, medical pioneers. Where other men laid out town sites and built railroads and created new industry, they explored the intricacies of the human body. They always assisted one another during operations, the sharp eyes of one seeing and noting what the others may have missed. They conferred and discussed and analyzed each operation they performed, suggesting new methods they would try the next time. And they traveled, watched other noted surgeons at work throughout the United States and Europe. They studied, pored over the medical books and journals together, constantly seeking to know more and more. By 1905, the fame of the Mayo Clinic was well established, and Dr. Will and Dr. Charlie were renowned as surgeons the world over. But Minnesota had other medical pioneers, other great men too. There was Dr. Charles N. Hewitt, Minnesota's apostle of public health. William Watts Farwell called him. It was way back in the 1860s that Dr. Hewitt began to talk about something new, something radical in those days.
We need more doctors, more good doctors, and we need better medical training, more education. But we need something else. We need a state government that makes the good health of its citizens a matter of public concern.
And under Dr. Hewitt's urging, the legislature in 1872 established the Minnesota State Board of Health. Dr. Hewitt was named secretary of the board, a position he filled with skill and energy for 25 years. At his insistence, quarantine for contagious diseases was made compulsory. He stressed the importance of vaccination to rid Minnesota of its dreaded smallpox epidemics. Under his guidance, the legislature approved pure food and drug laws. He told the doctors they must fight for better sanitation at home and in the community, and for stream pollution control. He called for a better apparatus for disinfecting sick rooms, better classification for causes of death, better treatment of the mentally ill. In 1903, also at Dr. Hewitt's urging, a separate state board was organized to wage war on diseases of market animals. It was called the Livestock Sanitary Board. It fought against such diseases as glanders, rabies, and tuberculosis in cattle. And what Dr. Hewitt was doing on a state level, other doctors were doing for the cities and towns of Minnesota, the communities in which they lived. Minnesota was the first state in the Union to treat crippled children at public expense. The year 1897. And Dr. Arthur Gillette of St. Paul made an offer to the state.
And this
is a matter which has weighed heavily upon my conscience. How can we continue to go about our daily lives ignoring these children who, with proper medical care, have a chance of being restored, healed, to lead useful, happy lives? I am not a rich man, but I will treat free of charge all crippled children brought to me if this state will provide funds for their care and recovery.
The state met Dr. Gillette's offer with an appropriation of $5,000, and Dr. Gillette's great dream of free medical care for crippled children came true. In 1911, the Gillette State Hospital was opened in St. Paul. Doctors Mayo, Gillette, and Hewitt were among the outstanding medical pioneers in Minnesota's first half century. Men who looked beyond, far beyond, the needs of a frontier community to the complex medical problems that would one day face a grown-up state.
All right, nurse, let's have the graft. I can't see. Bring your light down, will you?
About there?
Fine. Scissors?
Take much trimming?
No.
How long? 5 hours, they said. That's what they said, 5 hours. Seems twice that now. And they're patching Tommy's heart. Patching it. It's 5 hours. Can anybody live that long, a machine doing the heart and lungs work, about half of that time, I guess? 2.5 hours with no blood going through the heart. I never thought I'd see this. Never dreamed I'd live to see anything like it in all my life.
During this season of the year, the Christmas season, our thoughts turn more and more to home, family, things that are of most importance. Here's another good thought to put up there beside a family thought. Every family needs a savings account. Twin City Federal is a good place to save. More and more families throughout our whole Northwest are building toward new homes, toward security, toward college funds, toward brighter lives by saving where the twin clock flashes the time and the temperature. You have a cordial invitation to join them. Twin City Federal accounts are insured for safety, and the current dividend rate is 3.5% compounded quarterly. Why not stop in? Look for the familiar twin clock flashing the time and the temperature in downtown Minneapolis or St. Paul. Plenty of free parking for you right at the door. You're listening to Minnesota Milestones, coming to you from your Centennial Station in St. Paul and Minneapolis, WCCO.
Today, when we see the mighty group of buildings that is the University of Minnesota School of Medicine, it's hard to believe that once the teaching of medicine at the university was bitterly opposed. The protest was led by the operators of many private medical schools who had turned loose an army of quacks to practice upon an unsuspecting public. These operators were dependent upon student fees for their living, and they raised a mighty outcry over their threatened loss of revenue. William Watts Falwell, president of the university back in 1883, moved with caution.
Now, what I am proposing, gentlemen, is a new kind of service to be offered by the state. I recommend a board of 5 trained men, all competent doctors, to examine and license all those who seek to practice medicine in our state. I recommend the university do this, in order that examinations for degrees might be separated entirely from the teaching of the theory and practice of medicine.
Falwell's plan was accepted, but it remained for one member of the examining board, Dr. Perry Millard of Stillwater, to push through the storm of opposition and controversy and present his plan to the Board of Regents. And on February 28, 1888, agreement was reached. The Minnesota Hospital College of Minneapolis and the St. Paul Medical College surrendered their charters and were absorbed into the new Department of Medicine at the University of Minnesota. 1 month later, the Minnesota College of Homeopathic Medicine joined. leaving only the Minneapolis College of Physicians and Surgeons as the remaining private medical school. And it shortly became the medical department of Hamline University, which later also merged with the University of Minnesota. By 1910, through the various mergers, the medical faculty had become so large, unwieldy, and overmanned that so-called experts tumbled over one another. The president of the university, George Edgar Vincent, decided in 1913 that the time had come to act, and he acted dramatically.
By the first day of February, I am requesting that every member of the medical faculty of this university place in my hands his written resignation.
Amidst the roar of protest that arose, Vincent acted decisively again. He appointed a committee to reorganize the school and arrange a compact, workable teaching staff in each of the departments. Dr. Will and Dr. Charlie Mayo's clinic at Rochester had accumulated a vast sum of $1,500,000. In 1914, they organized the Mayo Foundation for the purpose of advancing medical science, and they proposed a close affiliation with the university. The group that had been dropped from the medical school faculty the year before opposed it.
This is nothing but part of a foul plot. This plan was hatched by President Vincent and Dr. Will Mayo prior to the reorganization of the medical faculty. Those of us who might have opposed such a union, you and you and you, we were all eliminated, put out of the way.
There were other charges, some of them quite reckless.
The whole plan is a great ugly scheme on the part of the Mayos to circumvent the medical profession's rigid ban on publicity and advertising.
The purpose of this merger is merely to promote the Rochester community. Real estate promoters in Rochester will become rich.
The teaching of medicine would be taken away from the university and moved to the Mayo Clinic.
The Guilford Bill, designed to prevent the affiliation, was introduced into the 1915 session of the legislature, but failed to pass. When the legislature met in 1917, the opposition arose again. Officials of the university considered the situation so serious, they went to see Dr. Will Mayo.
Doctor, as you no doubt read, a public hearing will be held next week at which our opponents plan to repeat once more the lies which they've uttered against us for the past 4 years. Dr. Mayo, we feel the only hope for the foundation is an appearance before the committee by you. Will you do it? Will you speak?
Well, I don't know. This has been most trying. But if you gentlemen think it's necessary, I'll do it.
There is no written copy of his speech. The only record we have is the notes taken by newsmen who were present. But those who were there say it was one of the most moving speeches they had ever heard. The opposition bill died in the 1917 legislature. And within a few years, the affiliation of the University Medical School with the Mayo Foundation was achieved. The immediate result was to bring to the foundation and to the university many distinguished doctors and researchers, paving the way for the mighty upsurge in medical science that swept through Minnesota in the 1930s. As for the Mayo Clinic properties themselves, Dr. Will and Dr. Charlie wanted to be certain that the clinic would live on after them, so they incorporated the Mayo Properties Association. In 1928, a new clinic building was dedicated and occupied. Complete with all its equipment, it cost the Mayo Properties Association $3 million and took more than 2 years under construction. For 30 years, the 15-story building dominated the city of Rochester. It still stands, but has been supplemented by a newer, more modern clinic building, even larger than the first one. It was shortly after the 1928 clinic building was opened that Dr. Will arrived at his office from St. Mary's Hospital. He appeared deeply depressed. His secretary was alarmed.
Why, Dr. Will, what's the matter?
I've just done my last operation.
Your last operation?
Yes, I want to stop while I'm still good. I don't want to go on like some others I've seen past my prime, doing the surgery that younger, sure men ought to be doing.
Dr. Will never spoke of the matter again, and he never performed another operation. That was the only outward sign of a decision that must have been one of the hardest of his entire life. Dr. Charlie retired a year and a half later, and quite unexpectedly. One morning as he was operating, he noticed that his vision was blurring. Skilled diagnostician that he was, he knew what had happened. He had suffered a retinal hemorrhage. Dr. Charlie was up and about after a few weeks' rest, but he was never really well again. On August 8th, 1934, Rochester paid elaborate tribute to its two famous sons. The speaker that memorable night was the President of the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
For 50 years, you have given tireless, skillful, and unselfish service here in this state and city. These 50 years, the span of your medical practice, have covered probably the most remarkable period in the history of science. You, whom we honor today, have rendered the highest form of patriotic service during the battles of the World War. But even more than that, you deserve the nation's thanks for the national service that you have rendered throughout your lives.
And the audience rose to its feet and applauded enthusiastically, vigorously, on and on, until at last both Dr. Will and Dr. Charlie waved their hands in protest. They had been awarded every honor the medical profession could bestow. They had been recognized and honored by kings and chiefs of state in the major countries of the world. But nothing equaled the ovation Dr. Will and Dr. Charlie received on that memorable night in Rochester back in 1934. Dr. Charlie died on May 26, 1939, of pneumonia. Dr. Will on July 28th that same year. And the medical world paused in its research and its healing labors, paused to take note of the end of an era, a milestone in history. Dr. Will and Dr. Charlie are not remembered for their surgery alone. As Dr. Will himself once said, "What a man may do with his hands is small compared with what he may do to implant ideals and the scientific spirit in many men who, in endless chains, will carry on the same endeavor."
I want to check the bleeding.
Is it all right?
You think so? Seems normal.
I'm ready for closure.
Yes, we're ready. Sutured.
It's nearly over. Thank God. Without these modern doctors and their training and research, poor Tommy, just a few years ago, would have been the end. And those nurses have been magnificent. Part of a team, almost reading the doctor's thoughts. A wonderful team. A whole room full of wonderful people. And the way they work together.
We may borrow a phrase from our good doctor friend. Working together has an application in some other fields, too. For example, get some dollars working together in a Twin City Federal Savings account, and all manner of good things start happening. First of all, your confidence starts building, your security grows. Second, you see your wishes starting to come true. That new home you may want, for example, starts looking closer and closer. Helping this happy feeling, liberal dividends. You always earn a generous return, saving at Twin City Federal. So one of these days, right soon, how about giving it a try? Get some dollars together, get them working together by saving them at Twin City Federal. Look for the twin clock flashing the time and the temperature in downtown Minneapolis and St. Paul. Plenty of free parking for you right at the door.
Thank you.
Before 1909, the only training for nurses in Minnesota was on the job training at St. Joseph's Hospital in St. Paul, the first hospital in the state, and at St. Barnabas Hospital in Minneapolis. Then in 1909, the training school for nurses was established at the university, a new training school, one that required a college education. Opposition arose in the medical faculty.
Educating nurses? I've never heard of such a thing. Why, they'll overtrain, overeducate those girls. And they won't want to take orders from doctors. This is ridiculous.
But the School of Nursing had a friend in Richard Olding Beard. Being an educator, rather than a doctor, he took a different view.
I cannot agree with those faculty members who oppose this plan. I believe the nurse needs more education to make her conscious of her duty, to make her conscious of her opportunity to serve the public.
So the School of Nursing came into being and grew under the guidance of its founder, Miss Louise Powell, followed by Marion Veneer and Catherine Densford.
The School of Dentistry had its difficulties also, and the pattern was exactly the same. First, a period of trial and establishment. Second, reorganization and growth. And third, maturity and achievement. Dentistry was established in Minnesota as one of the medical sciences in 1888. 3 years later, it achieved separate status. But it did not reach full stature until a great figure in dentistry, Dr. Alfred Oury, took charge in 1905. Dentistry had lagged behind medicine, and long after medical school ceased to deserve a bad name, there were still commercialized diploma factories in dentistry. By the time Dean Oury left the university in 1927, the School of Dentistry had achieved full stature, full medical recognition. It was in 1929 that Dr. Peter Breckus began an exhaustive project. He examined 3,000 freshman students. 10 years later, he examined another group of 3,000. And in 1949, a third group. The findings amazed Dr. Breckus himself.
Our research shows that while the human body shows improvement, human teeth are deteriorating steadily.
In 1943, Dr. Breckus and Dr. Knudsen of the United States Public Health Service conducted a large-scale experiment with school children. And from that experiment has come, in many communities, fluoridation of municipal water supplies to reduce the alarming increase in tooth decay.
And then came the campaign against paralytic poliomyelitis, the crippler, the killer, the disease that terrified parents. The medical profession had known about polio for many years. Doctors had diagnosed its cause as a virus, a deadly virus that could strike a healthy child, a healthy adult, and in days, shrink and twist him to a pale, ghostly, pain-racked shadow. And the dreaded bulbar type meant almost certain death. The outbreak in the 40s was the worst in history.
...1944, 530 cases... 37 polio deaths in Minnesota. ...1946, 2,881 cases, 226 polio deaths.
1946, public hysteria was everywhere. Doctors cautioned that maybe, they didn't know for sure, but maybe the disease was contagious. They advised against public meetings, gatherings, large crowds. The movie theaters were nearly empty. And in the hot, sultry days of August, the beaches were quiet, deserted. And still the hospitals filled with victims. Above the hysteria rose the determined figure of Sister Elizabeth Kenney, a woman with a mission in life. And her mission, to bring relief to those suffering from polio. It was a mission she had begun as a nurse in her native Australia, a mission she brought with her to the United States. Many doctors opposed the wet-pack technique of Sister Kenney's polio treatment, but some believed in her methods. Dr. Melvin Henderson of Rochester and Dr. John F. Pohl of Minneapolis. It was Dr. Pohl who reported to the Hennepin County Medical Society.
To those of us who have seen Sister Kenney work, there is no doubt about her methods. In the acute stage of the disease, her methods offer greater hope for recovery, or at least for arresting the paralysis and easing the pain.
And there was further support from Dr. Wallace H. Cole of St. Paul and Dr. Melandy Knapp of Minneapolis. They collaborated on a report which said,
We have been favorably impressed with this work, both as a rationale of therapy and as to results. We personally believe this method will be the basis of future treatment of infantile paralysis.
The Kenny method included therapy and exercise, hot baths and hot packs for the withered, rigid muscles of the polio victim. That conflicted with established medical practice at the time, which required that the patient's limbs should be kept inflexible until the paralyzing spasms ended. The mayor of Minneapolis, Marvin Klein, believed in Sister Kenny and her treatment, and he invited her to remain, to set up her clinic in Minneapolis and carry out her life's work. A later mayor of Minneapolis, Hubert H. Humphrey, who became a United States senator, recalls those days in the 1940s.
We had a very, very bad polio epidemic. We set up an emergency polio committee with the doctors in charge of General Hospital, Dr. Hennekin, and Dr. Pohl, I believe it was. And with Sister Kenny, they really went to work. She again proved herself again in that epidemic, giving unceasingly tirelessly of her energy and her tremendous talent. I literally saw her every morning around 7 o'clock and saw her many nights visiting with her to see what we could do. Those were terribly difficult days for all of us. I'll never forget them. She believed so strongly in what she had. She had worked this technique out, as I understand it, through years and years of experience and training and study. And it went contrary to the old established traditions of how you treated polio patients.
Fortunately, Sister Kenny lived to see her methods and her judgment vindicated, at least by a large body of medical opinion.
This cannot be done of oneself alone. It is also written, I can of my own self do nothing. This is true in my own experience. I've had that faith since the age of 12 years. And it is well known amongst my companions and those who work with me that I have many, many times desired a certain thing. A great obstacle has been put in my way when I am trying to present to the world the truth concerning the work which I have been destined to give to this world. And by some unforeseen agent, the very evidence I so desire has come before me just at the crucial moment.
That was Sister Elizabeth Kenny. Though she died in 1952, her work continues through the Sister Elizabeth Kenny Foundation, with headquarters in Minneapolis. Though polio continued to strike, reaching a peak of nearly 4,000 cases in Minnesota in 1952 and 206 deaths that same year, the use of the Salk polio vaccine has at last reduced the ravages of this dread killer and crippler.
And in the history of Minnesota, there is another dread story. Not so much a story of a killer and a crippler, but a story of man's inhumanity to man, a story of heartlessness and neglect. In 1947, it was, Governor Luther Youngdahl read an article by the Minnesota Unitarian Association. It told of conditions, deplorable conditions, in Minnesota's mental hospitals. The governor appointed a 47-member council on mental health to investigate the charges. And when the committee's findings confirmed what the article had said, Governor Youngdahl went to see for himself, visited every mental hospital in the state, talked with those in charge. History will record the results. The governor did make great strides toward stamping out the evils, the filth, the malpractice, the inhumanity in some of the mental hospitals. He won the support of the people of Minnesota. And in 1949, the legislature surpassed everything that had been done by state legislatures before it. A new mental health bill became the law of the state. And $28 million was approved to provide better food, better care for Minnesota's mentally ill. That legislative session provided $17 million to build and improve the mental hospitals, the shame of Minnesota. And today, through that effort, Minnesota is now a leader, has shown the entire nation the way toward merciful care and the miraculous cure of some of its mentally ill. It was in the 1930s that the University of Minnesota Medical School reached its maturity. With emphasis on original research and with the arrival of Dr. Owen Wangenstein as chief of surgery, one discovery followed another, new advances in the world of medical science. During the 1930s, the United States Public Health Service chose Minnesota as one of its centers for training in public health under the direction of Dr. Gaylord Anderson. There began the work of Drs. Irvin McQuarrie in pediatrics and Edward A. Boyden in anatomy. In the 1940s, Dr. Ansel Keys did his enormously significant study of starvation. And in the 1940s and 50s, the university began a long overdue program of building and expansion. The new buildings include the Variety Club Heart Hospital and the Mayo Memorial Center, the first of the university's skyscrapers, a towering hospital dedicated to research and increased medical knowledge. Research into another of mankind's dread diseases, cancer, is being carried on now in the gleaming laboratories and operating rooms. And Minnesota has another success story, another happy ending to a chapter in its history that has been all too tragic. Back in the 1800s, in the dark days of the diphtheria and smallpox epidemics, back in the days when tuberculosis and typhoid fever sent men, women and children to early graves. Many is the doctor who stood above the still, silent form of a patient and turned his eyes to heaven.
Oh God, have mercy upon me. I have failed thee. I have failed thy children through my ignorance. God, give me wisdom, knowledge. May I have the knowledge, the medicines, to cure and to prevent disease and suffering and death.
It took years, many years, but science did conquer at last. The miracle drugs, the medicines that could cure, they did come through the miracles of research. First came the serums, the vaccines, and the toxoids. And one by one, the epidemic diseases fell before the shining sword of better learning, better hospitals, better informed doctors. Vaccination wiped out smallpox. Inoculation reduced diphtheria and typhoid. And then in the 1930s and 40s came the wonder drugs. The sulfa family, penicillin, oreomycin, terramycin, and more recently, para-aminosalicylic acid. Whole families of wonder drugs that have begun to control the scourge of tuberculosis, venereal disease, whooping cough. And to bring new medical information to both the practitioner and to the rest of us, such men as radio's beloved Dr. William A. O'Brien of the university. One of the great miracle drugs, cortisone, was developed by two research men at the Mayo Clinic, Drs. Edward Kendall and Philip Hinch, two of Minnesota's great men of science. But it is not the miracle drugs that have conquered. It is the men who have conquered. The doctors and the hospitals and the public health nurses. For through their knowledge and their skill, they have begun to conquer the dread diseases that once killed and crippled and struck down. Another of Minnesota miracles of medicine. And among the modern medical miracles is the invention by Dr. Richard DeWall of the heart-lung machine, and the perfection of critical heart surgery techniques by Dr. C. Walton Lillehei and Dr. Richard Varco.
How many years, how many men's lives have been spent on the work, the research leading to this moment? 5, 10, 20 years ago, what chance would little Tommy have had? There would have been no chance, no hope. Yeah, the operation's over. About over.
Can you catch that bleeder?
Uh-huh. Got it. Any congestion?
No.
Pressure?
Okay.
Pulse?
Satisfactory. Okay, take him to the recovery room now.
And he'll be all right. Will Tommy...
Well, we have every reason to think so. You're a doctor, you know.
Yes, but just a country doctor, not a heart surgeon. And Tommy...
What do you mean you're just a country doctor? Your work is every bit as important as ours is. More important, I'd say. You know, Doctor, when I reach the climax of my career, I just hope I'll be able to say that I've saved as many lives as you have. And, Doctor?
Yes?
You can stop worrying about Tommy. Your grandson is going to be all right. He'll be all right.
And as the years lengthen into another century, we'll be hearing those words of assurance more often. Assurance that heart disease and cancer and arthritis have been turned back, along with other ailments which cripple and kill. We'll be taking even greater pride in the dozens of bright, new, well-equipped hospital buildings in the big cities and the small towns of our state. We'll long remember that it was during this centennial year that the people of Minneapolis and the federal government teamed up to raise $35 million for one of the most ambitious hospital construction programs in America. We'll continue to take pride in the bursting vigor of our healthful climate and the record of our Minnesota men in uniform, the healthiest men in service from any state. And we'll feel enormously proud of the men and women in white who deserve our tribute for their dedication to the pursuit of physical and mental happiness for their fellow men. These doctors and nurses, constantly battling disease and illness in the laboratories, in our hospitals, our small town clinics, and in the office of the country doctor. To those who work and study and seek the answer to the problems of the mentally ill, to those who work for the children who lie crippled in hospitals, to those who seek answers to the problems of aging, to all these, doctors, dentists, nurses, scientists, technicians, and pharmacists, Minnesota is looking to you for the answers to its hopes during the next 100 years.